Star Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
Now, here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again tonight is radio collector, historian, Ed Corcoran.
Well, hi, Dick. It's nice to be here again, and we have another famous guest tonight.
We certainly do. It's the great American character actor, Henry Hull. And we're doing this interview from his home in Lyme, Connecticut. What a pleasant night this has been so far.
Yes.
Jerry Haber of Channel 3's film department accompanied us and brought with him a personal copy of Great Expectations, a film Henry Hull starred in back in 1935, which we've just finished watching on Jerry's projector. Just seeing that film was a moving experience.
The whole production was very lavish and never been duplicated.
It is my understanding, Henry, that you never saw Great Expectations in its entirety, did you?
No, I didn't. I saw several shots of it. I mean, but I made it a point never to go into the cutting room, or never look at what they call rushes. Now, the reason for that is that no matter how good you might be or how bad you might be, any actor who watches his own rushes says, "Good heavens, is that me? I mean, could I be that bad?" Because no matter what you feel. No matter what you feel you have put into the camera, the same thing never comes out of it. So consequently, I made it a point, I think after the first one or two times I went in and saw the rushes, I said, never again, I will never look at them again. Consequently, I never saw any of the takes and never saw the picture, but it was put together. I just didn't like what I was doing particularly.
How does the picture stand up today?
Oh, it's been great after all these years.
I know you liked it, Ed, but you're a fan. I'd be curious to get your reaction, Henry.
Well, I feel that whoever the guy was, he was pretty good, you know. You have no feeling. When you look at yourself having played the character part, you have no feeling that it's you. You know, it's somebody else. It's the guy you were playing. At least you hope it is. And as you look at it, I told you before, you look at it and you see a scene, you say, "Oh, I remember that day. That's the day the fly got on my nose, and I had to scratch my nose and stop the shot." And then you see another shot, and you say, "Oh, yeah, I remember. That's the day. Oh, Lord, it was hot that day. It was supposed to be a snow scene." You know, the thing that you're playing, while it's very real coming off the screen, it of course carries with it memories of what was going on while you made it. You know, if there's a fight scene, you say, "Oh, ooh, I remember I hit that guy in the eye. I thought I'd killed him. And then he kicked me in the shins." We were just talking before about doubles. Most of the stuff we made 30, 35 years ago, you see, we didn't have doubles for it. Doubles came in much later because they were, let's say, a question of economics. If a star or if a leading player in the picture got in a fight or something, and, you know, in the picture, I mean, and got hurt, they might have to lay the picture off for 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, which was very expensive. The doubles came in after that famous fight. I think it was in a picture called The Spoilers, Bill Farnham and another actor, they had this terrific fight in the picture, and they really had a fight. They were friends, they were pals, and they said, "Come on, kid, let's go to it." And they knocked over tables, fell downstairs, and they stopped the picture for about 3 weeks while they went to a hospital. But personally, I never could, unless it was an awfully dangerous thing to do, I never could see the thing of having a double. I mean, if you couldn't do it, then don't try to do it.
Well, you've had major successes on Broadway and motion pictures and television, but we're interested in talking about radio tonight. And you were really active. You did a lot of shows.
I was really surprised he did so many in such a short time.
What did you think of radio?
Radio was built on crooks and sick people and doctors and cops. All of our programs were either cops chasing robbers or robbers chasing cops or nurses chasing doctors or doctors chasing nurses or both of them chasing patients.
Well, that isn't on radio anymore. But have you watched television lately?
I have. Oh, yes, I have two or three programs that we watch more or less religiously.
Well, there are nurses chasing doctors, and there are crooks, and there are police. Things haven't changed.
Yeah, I know. I don't look at those. All I look at now are travel pictures, you know. Mm-hmm. I like to go out with Lowell Thomas into the interior of New Zealand and see people, real people and things. What's it? And then there's the great adventure and anything I like.
Well, I'm sure our listeners are anxious to hear you in action. I know, Henry, that you narrated the Treasury Star Parade during World War II. These were patriotic dramas designed to promote the sale of war bonds. Is that right?
Yes.
Ed, can you come up with a copy?
Yes, I think I have one, Dick, that goes back to about that era. I haven't heard it myself in some time, so I'm looking forward to it to hearing it again also.
Treasury Star Parade. Produced under the personal direction of William A. Beecher, with David Brookman and his orchestra and chorus, Kenneth Spencer, a flock of Americans, and Henry Hall as our master of ceremonies.
This is Henry Hall, ladies and gentlemen, with another of the programs brought to you by the Treasury Department. It's the Freedom Road we're traveling today, and we're introducing a new song by Emerson Harper and Langston Hughes, sung by Kenneth Spencer, with David Brookman and the Augmented Treasury Orchestra and Chorus. For the first time on the air, the Freedom Road. Travel on, boys.
Lincoln said, "Government of the people, for the people, and by the people, shall not perish from the earth." Roosevelt said, "Freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear." Joe Louis said, "This is God's war. That's why I'm marching. Yes, I'm marching. I'm marching down Freedom Road. Ain't nobody gonna stop me. Ain't nobody gonna keep me from marching down Freedom Road. Hitler may rant, Mussolini may rave. I'm going after freedom if it leads me to my grave. That's why I'm marching. Yes, I'm marching. I'm marching down Freedom Road. Hand me my gun, let the bugle blow loud. I'm on my way with my head up proud. One objective I've got in view. Keep a hold of freedom for me and you. That's why I'm marching. Yes, I'm marching. I'm marching down Freedom Road. Ain't nobody gonna stop me. Ain't nobody gonna keep me. I'm marching down Freedom Road. China by our side, mighty Russia as our friend. I'm going after freedom and a new world at the end. That's why I'm marching. Yes, I'm marching. Marching on Freedom Road.
Now, to all of you within hearing of my voice, There's just one more thing I want to impress upon you. If you haven't already done so, answer your war bond protocol. That is important. It calls for at least 10% of everything you earn, 10% of your total income, invested in United States war savings bonds and stamps. Buy more if you can. For war savings bonds and stamps are your investment in the future security of America. Remember, this is your country. Keep it yours.
A brief excerpt from Treasury Star Parade. But Henry, you were the star of the very first suspense program that ever went on the air. By any chance, Ed, do you have a copy of that historic program in your collection?
Yeah, this is a very rare show, but I do have a copy.
What was the name of the show?
That was The Pit and the Pendulum, yes. Well, I was in the... Let me see. I've forgotten. But dear, what year did I play Cat and Canary? Do you remember?
1941.
Well, it was when I was playing the Cat and the Canary that somebody approached me about doing a thing, radio thing. And that's I told you that we got in a taxi cab and went across the Jersey Flats to a department store in...
Bamberger's.
L. Bamberger and Son. And we went up on the third floor. And there was a little bit of room, about 8 by 8, all hung with monk's cloth and very thick carpet on the floor. And the thing hung down from the middle looked like a dishpan. And they called it, they said, that's a microphone. And they explained to us all, they said, now you have to be very careful and speak every word distinctly. Start it and finish it, otherwise the dishpan will not pick it up. So we did that. And then... it was a recording. You remember the time we came up later, dear? We came up and we're going to a picture theater over here, and I heard this awful voice coming out of it, and I said, ooh, that sounds like me. And you gave me a look and said, it is you. It is you at your worst, what it was. This was a recording. Well, they had not developed the super-sensitive microphone. You see, a microphone today... I don't know about this thing is sticking in front of my nose now. But the microphone of the day will pick up that, you see. Where in the old days, you had to be very careful about every word. And they tell you now, I mean, people coming in pictures and things, they say, look out, this is a panchromatic, supersonic, hyperbolic microphone, and be very careful when you draw your breath in. Well, from that on, things developed until we get... I haven't done any radio in quite a long time. I don't doubt if anybody else has. Well, I mean, you know, like we used to do, like things like the suspense program and those things.
This is your narrator, the man in black, again about to introduce tonight's Columbia program, Suspense. The story is The Pit and the Pendulum by Edgar Allan Poe, the adaptation by John Dixon Carr. Our guest is the distinguished American actor, Mr. Henry Hull, who plays the part of a prisoner of the Spanish Inquisition.
I was sick unto death with a long agony. And when at length they unbound me and I was permitted to sit, I felt that my senses were leaving me. The sound of the inquisitorial voices seemed merged in one dreamy, indeterminate hum. Yet, for a while, I saw, but without terrible an exaggeration, I saw the soft and nearly imperceptible waving of the sable draperies on the walls of the room. I saw the flames of the 7 tall candles which burned on the table. I saw the lips of the black hooded judges, and these lips appeared to me white as paper, white as horror.
I saw them writhe.
With a deadly locution, I saw them fashion the syllables of my name.
Jean Delbray! Captain Jean Delbray!
Good fathers, gentlemen.
We hear you, my son.
I am very weak and infirm. I've been confined for many months in a dungeon. I've been tormented by nightmares.
Conscience, one trusts. Pray silence, Fra Antonio.
Even now, I have no knowledge of where I am or to whom I may be speaking.
You are speaking to me, my son. I am Fra Pedro de Espella, prior of the Dominicans of Segovia and Grand Inquisitor of all Spain.
Is this the court of the Inquisition?
It is.
Oh, then God help me.
He will help you, my son, if you trust him.
But I am a French officer.
That is true. A soldier and creature of the Archfiend Napoleon Bonaparte.
But a French officer nonetheless. A prisoner of war. By what right do you try me in this court?
Let the clerk read the charges against this prisoner. Pray silence while the clerk reads the charges.
The charges against the prisoner are as follows. Imprimis, that he is Juan Jean d'Albret, a captain of artillery in the army of Bonaparte, so-called Emperor of the French.
This means nothing, as the prisoner says. It is no crime. Proceed.
Item, that on the 4th day of September in the year of our Lord, 1808, that on the 12th of October, 1808, the Sir Jean d'Albret, being in command of a 5-gun battery of light artillery, did direct the fire of his guns against the holy church of St. Martha the Innocent.
What?
And thereby of his wicked malice destroyed that church utterly.
Captain d'Albret, is this charge true?
It is, yes.
You admit it?
Good father, hear what I have to say. The church blew up, I think.
Will you boast of your opinion, young man?
It blew up because it was stored with kegs of gunpowder for your army. I had every right to fire on it.
And that is all the defense you have to make?
I tell you, I had every right to fire on it. It's by military law.
What's military law above God's law?
I don't know. I did my duty, that's all.
Long live the Emperor!
Captain d'Albret, mark what I say. No man, however great his heresy, is ever condemned to be burnt in the fire.
Fire?
Fire. If he first recant and acknowledge the error of his ways. But for you, Jean d'Albret, there can be no mercy, no pity, no atonement. The only sentence of this court can be death.
Death. When I regained consciousness, I lay on my back and at full length on a low framework of wood. To this framework, I was securely bound by a long fastening resembling a surgical bandage. Bound? But why?
Why? Why?
The bandage passed round and round my body, leaving at liberty only my head and my left arm. With much exertion, I could supply myself with food from an earthen dish on the floor beside me. It was meat, highly seasoned, but there was no water. Beatrice, where are you?
Here, John, as always.
I can see you now. I can see you as clearly as I saw you months ago.
Oh, I wish it were true.
Your bonnet and the parasol you carried in summer and the high-waisted blue dress.
You are weaker, my dear, and more fevered.
Have I been asleep?
Yes, John.
They must have been here while I slept. They have bound me. Why?
Why?
Why? Why?
Stop those voices! Why? Stop them!
Mine too, Jean.
Why?
I am not here either, you know. Don't drive me away.
Beatrice, look.
Where?
At the ceiling of this room. 30-40 feet up, what do you see?
I see painted on the ceiling the figure of Father Time.
Anything else?
But Father Time carries no sign.
No.
He carries instead what looks like a gigantic pendulum. From an ancient clock.
About one thing, I swear I'm in my right senses. I saw that pendulum move.
A painting cannot move.
Yet I swear the pendulum did move. It swung a little back and forth, just like a real pendulum.
Try not to trouble your brain.
That pendulum is real. Beatrice, take care.
Take care of what? You're not looking at the pendulum now.
Take care of the rats in the pit.
I see them.
They're swarming out in dozens. You can see their eyes glitter. One of them ran across the hem of your dress.
Did it, Sean?
What do they want?
They caught the scent of the meat in the dish beside
you. But they'll not get it. Go away, go away, you vermin!
Move your hand above the plate, Jean. Move!
Beatrice! Beatrice, where are you going? I can hardly hear you.
You are sending me away, Jean.
I am sending you away.
My poor loved one. You can't bear to see the rats running about my feet.
Beatrice! Beatrice! Beatrice!
In a cell swarming with vermin. There are others I had rather see here. I'd rather see.
Did you call me, Captain Dalbray? Then in spirit, I am here.
Who are you?
Don't you recognize me?
No, I do not.
I am that second inquisitor, Fra Antonio, whom you thought unfair at your trial. But we were not unfair. We administer the law. That is all.
Go. I command you. Go.
Not until I have first told you what you already get.
Which is?
There are two forms of death for such as you. One, death with its direst physical torture. The other, death with its direst mental torture.
And I have been condemned to the second?
Your guess is good. Listen.
Ed,
do you hear anything?
Yes, yes, I do. I hear something.
Turn your eyes upwards.
Yes.
Look at the ceiling.
The pendulum.
Aye, the pendulum.
It's descended.
Only a foot or so as yet. As you notice, it is not really a pendulum. Its underside is a crescent formed of sharp, of razor-sharp steel.
You mean?
A ponderous weight, Captain Dalbray. Its movement is slow now, but soon it will take on momentum. It will swing wider and wider, 30 feet perhaps. Presently, as it swings, you will hear it hiss. And with each broad movement, it will creep a trifle slower.
Steel is directly above me.
Yes. Above the region of your heart. Lie still and look up at it.
How long before?
You need have no immediate fear. It will not be too soon.
But how soon?
Who can tell?
In the name of pity, give me some answer.
Ours. Perhaps days.
It's beginning to swing wider. I can't take my eyes from it.
Its glitter fascinates you. Eh? See how it shines in that wild light.
And this is your utmost refinement in cruelty.
The law, Captain Dalbray, is never cruel. And now, still in spirit, I leave you to your meditations. It will not be too soon. Minutes, hours, days.
A suffocating heat pervaded the prison. A deeper glow settled in the painted eyes that glared at me. I could draw no breath of air into my lungs. Against the loom of that fiery destruction, the thought of the pit and its coolness come like a soothing balm. I staggered to the edge of the pit. I looked into it. The enkindled walls and roof lighted it with depth. Yet for one wild moment, even then, I refused to believe the horror of what I saw beneath me.
Does the pit please you, Captain Dalbray?
Does the pit, merciful God, anything but that?
And how shall you avoid it? Look.
Dungeon has changed its shape.
That is true. Walls are closing in. It was formerly a square, and now it is
flattened slowly toward the center to force me into the pit.
Of course.
Ah,
Well, it'll force you along with me.
Again, apparently you must be told, Captain Dalbray, that you are speaking only to your own sick fancy. I am not here at all. Farewell.
Now closer and closer through the red burning walls, forcing me into the pit with a swiftness that left me no time for thought. I shrank back, but the closing wall pressed me relentlessly onward. At length, for my seared and writhing body, there was no longer an inch of foothold. I screamed once. I trotted on the edge of the pit. The wall rushed back. An outstretched arm caught my own as I was about to fall fainting into the abyss. It was that of General LaSalle. The French army had entered Toledo. The Inquisition was in the hands of its enemies.
And so closes Poe's celebrated story, The Pit and the Pendulum, starring Henry Hull. We invite you to another adventure of suspense next Tuesday at the same hour. Until then, this is the Man in Black saying good night.
William Spear, the producer, John Dietz, the director, Bernard Herrmann, the composer-conductor, and John Dixon Carr, the author, are collaborators on Suspense. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. And it was all done with just the voice.
No makeup, nothing else.
Henry, you were born into show business, weren't you?
Well, more or less, yes. I mean, I was born in... my father was... I told you before, a word... It sounds like a dirty word now, you know? See, when I say my father was an entrepreneur... Woo! Well, an entrepreneur in those days... See, my father, being an entrepreneur, all I remember about him mostly was he wore a silk hat and a frock coat. Well, that made him an entrepreneur. But he was... in the theater, and it was, he spoke several languages, and it was his job to import stars from Europe and bring them here and handle their tours. So consequently, I was more than born in the theater. I knew too much about it, you know, so I decided I had two brothers to... I hope that nobody old enough listening to me now who remembers a musical comedy called Floradora. Well, anyway, they were in it.
Your brothers.
Yeah. They were in the famous sextet. And, but then I had, being intimately in the theater, you see, they were always out of work, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wanted a job where I could draw some pay every week or every month or something. And, although it wasn't as risky in those days as it is today, because there was such a thing as the road. You see, if a play were a success in New York, you, the actor, was pretty sure of 2 or 3 years' work in that same play. Because we'd say that it was a play that Mr. Frohman produced with John Drew or Maud Adams or Ethel Barrymore, or it ran at the Empire Theater for 20 weeks, and then it played, it had Philadelphia... 4 weeks, Boston, 4 or 5 weeks, Chicago, 10 or 12. You see, the second full season was on the road. Your third season was playing the week stands and the one-night stands. Well, today, if a play is a success in New York, they immediately get 5 other companies and send them all out at once. See, to be able to capitalize on the immediate success of the play, and they send them out. Two cities that still have theaters. Mm-hmm. Of course, so few of them have. I played years and years ago a one-night stand at New London. Now, there was a theater there. It's now a parking lot. Now, I'm sure that all over America, there are hundreds of new Londons where there were theaters, they are now parking lots. And then when they tore the theaters down, they built these gigantic cinema palaces. See? Now they're tearing the cinema palaces down, and they are parking lots, and we're all sitting in a home watching television. And what we're going to do next, I don't know.
We may be living in parking lots.
Well, a parking lot would be easy to take care of in this place, I'll tell you that right now.
Let's talk about some of your movies. You were in High Sierra with Humphrey Bogart. I remember going to the show to see Jesse James.
One of my favorite shows.
Were you also in The Return of Frank James?
I was in most of the Jesse James. Oh, yes. You see, the first Jesse James picture was Hank Fonda, Ty Power, so on and so on. And, of course, at the end of that picture, as you know, Jesse was shot, you know, hanging the picture and all that right. Hooey. Then we made The Return of Frank James. That was just with Hank Fonda. Then we made another one, The Return of Jesse James. That was with John Ireland. Well, that was quite another idea. That was the story of Cole Younger, who, after the James boys were more or less, Jesse was... Frank, you see, just disappeared. Frank eventually, it's very unromantic. Frank, for years before he died, was the doorkeeper in the Missouri legislature, you know.
That was not portrayed in the film, I take it.
Well, there's nothing very romantic or exciting about opening the door for a lot of congressmen, is there, you know? especially since you've been opening doors with a big .44 in your hand, opening in doors of safes and things.
Of course, one of your most memorable films was The Werewolf of London, a picture directed by Stuart Walker. He did great work on the screen.
He had overflow audiences all the time. So.
Tell me about him.
Stuart Walker was not really a motion picture director. Stuart Walker was a man who was a producer and had his own stock company, I believe, in not Indianapolis, somewhere in Indiana, and had done very fine things. He was a very good playwright. He was, I think, a little bit too good for the pictures of his day. He only made one or two after Werewolf, and I think he retired. Or, you know, people in Hollywood, you say, oh, where is Bill, or where is Jim, or where is... They suddenly they drift into the light, and they drift out to the light. Nobody knows how, or why, or where. That's Hollywood.
This is the one and only horror film you ever made, is that right?
Well, yes. It was the second of the horror films made out there. And it was our version, more or less. Mr. Robert Louis Stevenson, Dr. Jekyll, and Mr. Hyde, the two personalities. You see, Stevenson's idea was that a man's inner personality affected his body, affected his looks even, you see. So in Jekyll and Hyde, we have the straight, handsome, upright Dr. Jekyll, and then we have the almost bestial, light-footed, humpbacked Mr. Hyde. The idea being that the man's personality, the man's soul, we'll say, affected the looks of his body.
Certainly they affected the looks of your body. The makeup people must have had a great time with you. How long did it take to make a change in those days?
Well, it all depended. You see, I think I told you before that there are several shots in the Werewolf, there's one where the botanist is sitting at his table, and there was a lovely trick shot because his cat was on the table beside him. He reached out to pet his cat, and at that moment, the weird flower he had picked in Monongahela or someplace began to take effect on him, and then the change was made in something like eight different exposures of the same camera. For example, they would shoot, let's say, 30 feet of just this man as he was. And then they would rewind. You see, by rewind, I mean they take the same film and wind it backward for 15 feet. Now, then you are on. Then you go make the first makeup change, which was done with lights. Now, you get in exactly the same position. You must. Because then they photograph and open up the lens, and the gradual on that 15 feet, you begin to see the other man coming in. Now that is repeated 7 or 8 times until you go from the straight thing into whatever they want to make you look like, a wolf or a snake or a gopher or heaven knows what their weird ideas out there may suggest to them.
You still get fan mail to this day from horror fans, don't you?
Well, that is from television, of course. They have sold these pictures outright instead of... And I have 2 sons who are both television producers, and they both call me, they say, "Pop, you have now become the king of the late, late shows." They tell their friends, "If you want to see my father, you got to sit up at 2 o'clock in the morning."
How do you feel when you see yourself on a late movie?
As a matter of fact, out of curiosity, sometimes I sit up and look at them. But I suppose it's more or less like reading the pages of a diary you wrote when you were in prep school. You know, you say, "I saw Molly today. My heart beat so fast. I saw Molly's lovely blue eyes glance at mine, and I saw her blonde hair stand up straight." You know, and you say, "Oh, good heavens, did I think that 30 years ago?" Well, it's the same thing when you look at an old picture you made or an old television film you made. Luckily, we can't go back and see everything we've done. We all get to the nearest river and jump in it.
You've just completed a new film, haven't you?
I just completed one, yes. We went down to the Great Smokies in Knoxville, Tennessee. That is, we lived in Knoxville, drove out every morning about 30 miles out into the mountains on the location of the thing. It was a picture based on the fact that even the day, the woman that wrote the book comes to that part of the country. They still believe in all sorts of witchcraft and all, you know, other things. And that's what the picture was about. But the thing that impressed me most, much more than picture making, we lived in Knoxville and drove out 25, 30 miles to this location, to this house we'd rented for the location, the thing. And I have never in my life, now I was born in Kentucky. My father was on the Courier Journal, and we used to go up into the Cumberland Mountains. And I thought I had seen poverty. I thought I'd seen poverty around, well, certain spots in Connecticut. We won't mention where. But I have never seen any... This was a couple of months ago. I have never seen such abject poverty as I did see in the Great Smokies. And here was... I found out why. These people that we rented this house from, the house was falling to pieces. The porch was falling off. They had no toilet facilities whatsoever. They had no running water. They carried their water in a bucket from a brook about 20 yards away. Of course, they had no electricity. They had nothing. Now, we gave them $600 just to photograph the front of their house as a location, as we call it in pictures. Now, one would have thought that under normal circumstances, anybody getting $600 who had never seen $600 in their lives before would have spent the money on some new clothes or putting in some running water or getting a decent stove in the kitchen. Or, you know, so many things you might think of, they might have done. What did this family do with the $600? They went out and they bought a hi-fi set, but they had no current. You see, as long as we were there, we let them tap into our power truck. Mm-hmm. But when we pulled the power truck out, there was no way to work the thing. There was no current within 20 miles. But the whole idea was Not the TV set, not the hi-fi set. The idea was that they had a hi-fi set, and their neighbors down the road and their neighbors up the road didn't have a hi-fi set. That's the only reason they bought it.
What was the name of the picture?
It was called The Fool Killer. We made it just outside Knoxville, Tennessee, in the Great Smokies. And it appears the woman that wrote the original book from which the picture was made was born and brought up down there. And the legend of the pool killer still does exist in certain parts of the world. They say in the Great Smokies. Well, of course, it's so obvious that if you go through life being a damn fool, the sooner or later you're going to get it, you know. So consequently, the legend of the pool killer is still alive. If it's a very cold night and you think the river is frozen over and the ice is only about an inch thick and you walk out on it, you're going to drown. You see? Well, then they said the pool killer got him, right. Naturally. So many things we do that are foolish end up in getting in, and you're getting injured or killed or something. Consequently, as legends grew, they had to be embodied. They had to be not just an influence, they had to be a person. You know, like the devil's got horns and a tail and a pitchfork and the Underwood's deviled ham and everything on it. And we must, in order to appeal to the imagination, let us say, of the untutored, we must embody ideas.
Yeah, it's true. Ed, let's take time out to listen to another of Henry Hull's radio appearances.
Well, I have one from early in his career, which is the only copy in the United States, Dick.
Whoa, I'm impressed. Here is Henry Hull in an excerpt from Gulliver's Travels.
This is the NBC University Theater, bringing you a full-hour dramatization of the Jonathan Swift classic, Gulliver's Travels, starring Henry Hull as Lemuel Gulliver. This is a story written by a man who searched his fellow men and found nothing but greed and vice and evil.
My name is Lemuel Gulliver, and this is the journal of my travels about the world. For 16 years, I sailed the seas first as surgeon and then as captain of my own vessel. And in that time, I have had adventures the like of which few men can dream, and I shall feel the stamp of it for all my days. It all began in the year 1699, when I accepted a berth aboard the vessel Antelope, bound for the South Seas. I shall not trouble you with the particulars of that voyage, but let it suffice to say that in our passage, we ran afoul of a tropic storm. The weather being very hazy, we had lookouts posted every masthead. Then suddenly, through the fog, a voice cut down from aloft.
Stick around to port! A rock! A rock a half table's length!
Too late, you saber! Stand by to launch the longboat!
Aye, sir! All hands to quarters! Jump there!
The rock! The rock! We're on it!
The good ship Antelope foundered almost immediately, and we were all consigned to the mercy of the waves. But there was no mercy in that madness. I grasped a floating timber and held on, tossed heavenward by the giant swells, and then dashed down into the roaring seas. Some hours later, I was awakened by a noise like the humming of insects, a silken whispering like grass in the wind. I tried to rise, only to find my arms and legs fastened securely to the ground, and the very strands of my hair pegged out in the same manner. And suddenly, I heard a buzzing near my head, a strange, high-pitched, fluttering sound. I did not move my head, but as I listened to this tiny buzz, I thought the sun and waves had unhinged my senses. For as I listened closer, more intently...
Mad Mountain.
Man Mountain?
It was true.
Man Mountain?
There were words. A little insect humming was really words. I wrenched my head free and peered down at my chest and saw him.
Man Mountain. Listen, Man Mountain.
It was a man. A human creature not 6 inches high, advancing gently forward upon my breast, and following him a company of 50 of the same kind, armed with bow and arrow.
Captain, make sure of the boat. The Man Mountain may escape. Company forward!
Avast there, you rascals! Off me! Loose me!
Steady, men! The Man Mountain is securely tied.
Let me get...
Captain, take 2 men and explore yon cavern in his head.
Here now, stay off me! Get out of my nose! Get out of my... That sea you sent you sailing? Now loose me, do you hear? Untie me.
Hear me, Man Mountain.
What? Still here? You're a strange little creature. Not 6 inches high, yet as perfectly formed as any man.
Hear me, Man Mountain. I am Red Whistle, the King's Minister of Private Affairs. I shall try to help you.
Hi, little man. Help me first by unloosing my hair. It pulls most painfully.
First, you must see the king.
Well, if you'll not unloose me, then you must feed me. I am fair, faint with hunger.
Well, that is attended to. Yonder on the plain, a herd of cattle approaches, and I've sent to the king's cellar for several hogsheads of wine. Now, be content, Man Mountain, and remember, Red Whistle is your friend.
And so I came to the land of Lilliput. I was at first strongly tempted to break my bonds and seize up a handful of these tiny men who had dealt so audaciously with my person and dice them to the ground. But as I ate, my anger abated. In Lilliput, as in my own island, the state of a man's stomach is likely to govern his emotions. I topped off my meal with a hogshead of good wine, and then I fell asleep.
Man Mountain, wake up. The soldiers, shoot an arrow at him.
Ow, ouch! Ooh, what? What is it? Where am I?
You are in an ancient temple. It was the only building large enough for you. It took 1,500 horses to draw you here.
Why, what's that?
Oh, the Emperor. Oh, down on your knees, Man Mountain, quickly. It is the Emperor.
A mighty procession turned in the temple gate. Spearmen, bowmen, all no higher than my middle finger. And then, magnificent upon a war horse, 4 inches high...
His Imperial Majesty, Grabasto Mamaran, most mighty Emperor of Lilliput, delight and terror of the universe, monarch of all monarchs, at whose nod the princes of the earth shake their knees. Hear me, Man Mountain.
Your most humble servant, Your Majesty.
Oh, there. Oh, whoops.
Oh, perhaps I upset your charger, Your Majesty. Shall I lift you up to my ear so that we may converse?
Very well, Man Mountain.
Right, up you come, then.
Oh, very well, then. Hear me, Man Mountain. In the name of the Empire, I welcome you to Lilliput. You are to be protected from harm, providing you shall subscribe to certain articles under the Great Seal.
I have no choice, Your Majesty. In the presence of royalty, I am overcome with awe.
Of course. Now, Man Mountain, you will please stand with your legs planted wide.
Mm-hmm, yes, like this, Your Majesty?
Precisely. My father built an arch of triumph 70 grumguffs tall, but never in the history of Lilliput has there been a colossus such as you.
I am happy to please Your Majesty.
And now, my army shall parade beneath your arched legs. And I will go down in Lilliputian history. General, start the parade.
Henry Hull, our guest tonight, with an excerpt from Gulliver's Travels. Radio was great. It forced you to use your imagination.
Well, yeah, it sounds great.
How long have you made Lyme your home, Henry?
40 to 43 years.
Then you really never lived in Hollywood, am I right?
See, I never left Broadway for 22 years. I went right from play to play. In those days, a play that was at all a success a fair success. You were sure of at least one season's work in that play. For example, the first three plays I was in lasted us 7 years. Three plays, 7 years. That was The Man Who Came Back, Cat and Canary, and 39 East. And then I might say that possibly seven or eight plays I was in lasted me 12 or 14 years. Lulu Bell ran 104 weeks without stopping at the Belasco Theater. Grand Hotel ran 80-some weeks without stopping. Little plays that are forgotten. Michael and Mary, one full season. But that's all changed now. Mm-hmm. Because very, very, it's unusual for a play. Of course, they do happen, like this musical thing, you know, the Shaw play that ran 3 or 4 years. But that's most unusual. But 25 or 30 years ago, if a play were a fair success, you were sure of a good season's work. You see, they weren't getting $18 and $19 and $22 a seat, you know, to look at the things. There is no play, I mean, a straight dramatic play. There is no play ever written or ever played, according to my father. It was worth more than $2. Sarah Bernhardt, Tommaso Salvini, etc., etc. Their top price was $2 and there was no tax. It wasn't $2.20, it was $2. In those days, for example, I co-produced a play called Tarnish with a man that I had worked with named John Cromwell, who was a producer, worked for William A. Brady. We rang the curtain up on Tarnish at the Belmont Theater in New York, with Ann Harding, Tom Powers, a cast of that type. And we rang the curtain up for $6,000. You can't have a dress rehearsal now for $6,000.
I can imagine. Not knowing very much about Broadway, I at least can recognize that figure as being rather low. Especially
50 years ago, the biggest musical comedy, the things at the Casino Theater and those places, the entire budget was $25,000-$40,000. Now, when David Belasco put on a play, or William A. Brady put on a play, they put it on but with their own money. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody puts on a play with their own money. There is a class of people in New York of investors. You are a bright guy, you bring me a script. I like the script. I call a meeting of my investors. I read the script. I say it'll cost $100,000. Bill says, well, I'll take $10,000. His wife says, well, I'll take $5,000. Now the theater is, someone's going to put up a building. See, so they get 14 architects in. And each architect, see, one architect says, well, I think I'll do the cellar. And the other guy says, give me the fourth floor. Well, that is what you get finally. You get your play on. And
nobody bothers with the foundation.
No, but you suddenly discover that you got nobody ever built your roof, you know. So down comes the rain and drowns everybody.
Do you plan to do any stage work in the near future?
You often hear people say, I'm of two minds about that. Well, I'm of 102 minds about that. Number one, my wife has 75 cents of the first nickel I ever made. Consequently, we don't have to work for a living anymore. Number two, I'm not 30 anymore. I'm past 50. Oh, well past 50. Number three, it's got to be awful good. Oh, I haven't the vaguest interest in it. I think it's always been a theory of mine that if you have to do something for some very good reason, you will damn well do it the best you know how. But when you get to the point where you don't have to do it, then it's either going to be, well, you say, oh, I'll do it. But the enthusiasm isn't there, the drive isn't there, and, you don't get the same result, you know?
Well, that's something we never knew, Dick. That's very interesting.
Every bit of it has been interesting, Ed. Thank you so much for inviting us to your home tonight, Henry. It's been such a pleasure.
It's been a great pleasure for me. You know, I get rather annoyed with actors who complain about their fan mail, you know. What a bore, David. Any actor, when he stops getting fan mail, brother, he is through. Good night.
Good night, Henry Hull. My thanks to radio collectors Ken Schwartz of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C., and Dick Judge of Rochester, New York, for sharing their recordings with us. Now, until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel was produced and edited by Bob Schirago. This is Bill Hansen speaking.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day.